It's 9:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. President Obama's speech on Libya the other night has reignited debate over the so-called Obama Doctrine. What is it? How has it shaped American foreign policy? Well, those are just a couple of the questions we'll try to discuss and get some answers for this hour with a pair of guests. My first guest is Aaron David Miller, Public Policy Fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, former State Department analyst and negotiator, and author of The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here.
The term Obama Doctrine isn't new. I mean, I first heard it during the 2008 presidential primaries. It was used then to describe candidate Obama's approach to American foreign policy. Now he's the president. I suppose we need some way to characterize every president's foreign policy. But let's start by asking, what is the Obama Doctrine and how is it different from the Bush Doctrine?
Well, first of all, I don't think there is an Obama Doctrine. And the president's approach to foreign policy is quite different than the former president's, although there is an argument, a strong argument to be made on Afghanistan, Iraq, Guantanamo, for example, that Barack Obama has become George W. Bush. That is to say, there is great continuity in the president's approach on all of these matters. He doubled down in Afghanistan, said he was going to close Guantanamo, and then found it much too tricky and problematic, and has prosecuted the war against terror with an intensity and a ferocity which is quite a follow-on to Bush 43. So I think in that regard, there are similarities. I think the difference is that the president's freedom agenda, this president's freedom agenda, is not driven by the need to change regimes and to project American military and political power into areas that are easier to get into and much harder to get out of. And you see that that split-the-difference approach in the president's policy on Libya. I mean, the stated objective is the protection of civilians, but the achievement of that objective cannot be accomplished without the unstated objective being accomplished, which is the removal of Muammar Gaddafi. And even though the president has said Gaddafi must go, he's lost legitimacy, the way this thing is set up does not give the president or the coalition of the willing the means, at least right now, to remove him.
Well, now we just heard Defense Secretary Gates specifically say that removing Gaddafi is not part of the plan, and that's not that's something that the Libyan people will have to take care of.
Look, Secretary Gates is a really smart guy, and he's even more of a reluctant warrior than the president. The reality is the Libyan people cannot take care of it. 1,000, 2,000 guys with no military training, no command and control, no way of projecting their force hundreds of miles from where they are now to a city of 2 million people, Tripoli, from which Gaddafi is going to have to be removed somehow, unless an errant missile or a well-placed one takes him out or someone within his inner circle launches an internal coup. The reality is this will only end in one of two ways. The regime will crack very quickly as those around Gaddafi lose heart and hope, or alternatively, somebody is going to have to put proverbial boots on the ground and fight this war for the Libyan opposition, because they're clearly not capable of really fighting it themselves.
I guess the question then becomes, you know, why would we put, can we put boots on the ground in Libya? It seems to me that what we've been hearing is that our military is stretched pretty thin across the world. We're already in essentially two wars, and some people are asking, we're going to take on a third project like this?
Well, I think that would be foolhardy. I mean, we're not only involved in three wars, we're involved in three wars where Iraq, Afghanistan, and now Libya, where the standard for victory is not can we win decisively, but when can we leave? Extrication has become the hallmark of America's 21st century wars. No, I think it's a march of folly, to quote Barbara Tuchman. It's a march of folly to put American boots on the ground. I'm simply explaining to you, in my judgment, how this will end. It'll end quickly, much more quickly than anybody anticipated, because the regime fractures, and he's either forced through negotiations or killed, or alternatively, someone, not the United States, most likely the Europeans, the French are likely candidates here, will have to actually deploy on the ground or fight on behalf of the opposition in a much more aggressive way to take the war to Gaddafi. And that's going to mean large numbers of civilian casualties. Yeah, Tripoli is a city of 2 million people. Gaddafi has reportedly mined the entrances to the city. He will place tanks, artillery. He has sarin, mustard gas. And the question is, who is going to dislodge him? That's the real problem. And the president, obviously, when he conceived of this policy, realized that a quick no-fly zone plus might not answer the mail. But he's now in a position where our stated objective, the protection of civilians in Libya, depends on the fulfillment of our unstated objective, which is the removal of Gaddafi. Unless Gaddafi leaves, is killed, or forced out of Libya, civilians will never be safe or protected.
So let's you're saying that there really is no Obama doctrine, and
the Obama doctrine, I was quoted in the New York Times the other day. I said, if there's an Obama doctrine, it's this: if we can, if there's a moral case, if we have allies, and if there's a way to enter quickly and get out, then we'll move to help. That's the Obama doctrine.
One of the things that seems to have defeated a lot of efforts to characterize the president on anything is that, and I think this is something that's lost on a lot of people, I want to get your reaction to this, is that President Obama is at heart a pragmatist. He's interested in what works, which makes it harder for him, doesn't it, to get along with people who are more ideologically driven?
Well, I don't, look. As far as I'm concerned, American foreign policy, I worked for 6 secretaries of state and 5 administrations over the course of 25 years. American policy, foreign policy, and frankly domestic policy, ought to be driven not by the gaps and divides between left and right, liberal, conservative, Republican, or Democrat. It ought to be driven by the gap between smart on one hand and dumb on the other. And what the president wants to do is to identify smart policies, not dumb policies. And smart policies always require 2 things. They require an end game, a vision of how you want things to turn out, and a realistic, I use your word, pragmatic set of steps designed to accomplish those goals. The old notion that if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there, could well be a description of the way our Libyan policy is working right now. And again, I know this was a tough decision. The president had the option of interceding or watching bad pictures on television of Gaddafi's forces rolling into Benghazi and probably killing a lot of rebels or opposition figures, and maybe a whole lot of innocents as well. So he had to make a choice. This is a discretionary war. This is not a war of necessity. Afghanistan might have been in the beginning because of Al Qaeda's attacks on the towers and the Pentagon, which came from Afghanistan. But even Afghanistan has now turned into a war of choice. And Iraq was never a war of necessity. And Libya is not a war of necessity. Necessity implies vital interest. Vital implies literally relating to the vitality and the existence of a body. Libya is not vital to American national interest. The president is fighting a discretionary war, a war of choice. Now, is it a good choice or is it a bad choice? And that will depend almost entirely about how it comes out. If the regime cracks quickly and Gaddafi is killed or forced out of the country, the president's strategy will be judged to have been a major success. He'll be hailed as a brilliant and astute tactician. If this ends up...
How likely is that, though?
Well, I mean here's the real problem. Nobody knows. Because with the devolution of power in this region comes the devolution of authority. We don't know. Libya is a black box. And that's another constraint. I mean, the opposition, the president claims those that we vetted appear to be credible, but there are others. And anyway, those who are actually doing the fighting may not be the ones who ultimately, in the opposition, end up representing Libya. So he had a choice to make. He made it. It was a policy without a clear objective, or at least one that wasn't stated, and without the means at our disposal, either because we were unwilling to use them or we were unable to use them. And we have a volunteer army. I guarantee you that Iraq and Afghanistan have now gone on for 11 and 8 years, respectively. If we had a draft in this country, there's no way we would have been in these wars for the last 10 years. These are the first wars since the revolution that are fought by an all-volunteer army. Less than 1% of Americans, less than 1% of 320 million people, or thereabouts, are fighting these wars. When my father went to war in the South Pacific in 1942, America had 130 million people. 16 million of them put on the uniform. 16 million. So in some respects, the president has the luxury of being freed from some political constraints, not from the financial constraints, by the way. Because this is expensive. Every Tomahawk missile is $1 million. So we fired 150 of them. I mean, the costs start to mount. So I think this is a very uncertain situation. I think there is no expert in Washington that can tell you how it's going to end. I would simply sketch out for you two possible outcomes. The short game, which is, after the Libyan foreign minister, very close to Gaddafi, defects yesterday and goes to London. He's a wealth of information on the regime. And somebody paid him handsomely to defect and then to divulge. And it could set into motion other defections. And the regime could crack. There's no question that could happen. But then there's the long game, which is, it doesn't crack. And Gaddafi sits there ensconced in Tripoli with the opposition unable to take the war to him. And the coalition of the willing, NATO, the Arab League, and the UN, now faced with a really hard choice. You can basically let the status quo remain with two Libyas, with NATO protecting Eastern Libya and Gaddafi remaining strong in the West, or somebody can put boots on the ground and fight this war on behalf of the Libyan opposition. It better not be America. I voted for this guy the first time. I will not vote for him again if he puts American forces into Libya.
The forces of Colonel Gaddafi seem to be carrying the day against the revolutionaries, or however you want to term them. What happens if he just overwhelms them? I mean, you can't occupy territory with airplanes.
No, he could just wipe them out. NATO is prepared to maintain a no-fly zone plus. That is to say, we can stop a Libyan offensive against Benghazi. We'd have to pick up our air power and go after ground troops. I mean, we have a lot of capacity. Excuse me, NATO has a lot of capacity to do that. So I think you can keep Gaddafi at bay. But the question is, then you buy yourself a permanent presence, although in the air, and then ultimately on the ground, I would suspect, in Libya. And then you own Libya. And we don't want to own Libya. We don't want to own Libya.
Let's broaden the discussion for just a moment here. What about other areas of the world? How given the terms under which the president was willing to go along with the no-fly zone over Libya, what does this mean for other so-called humanitarian crises around the world? I mean, why wouldn't there be justification then for going into Darfur, Somalia, Liberia, the Sudan? How do we decide which parts of the world to engage and which parts to just allow to develop or crash on their own?
Yeah, you could add Ivory Coast and Congo to that list. Look, great powers behave hypocritically and inconsistently. They always have, and they always will. That's one of the realities of being a great power. You can get away with that. So we will decide where to intercede and where not to intercede. And that will depend on many different factors. It will never be enough to satisfy the purists in terms of intervention. Because we are not, I'll give you an example. The mullahocracy in Iran starts killing people in response to demonstrations in the streets. Non-Arab state, brutal regime, large amounts of support in the streets, though, for the regime, and a lot of opposition. But they start killing people, shooting people. Hundreds die. Is the United States going to establish a no-fly zone over Iran? Is the United States going to send CIA agents to direct fire against Iranian targets on the ground, as we're doing in Libya? Are we going to contemplate supplying arms to the Iranian opposition? I don't think so. And Syria may well be the same case. So Libya was easy because Gaddafi was despised universally. He had no support, even in the Arab world. He wasn't the kind of threat that the Iranians are. You could take military action against Libya without any fear once you neutralize their air defense systems, any kind of retaliation. Iran's a serious place. We are now involved in two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. The Iranians can make our lives and the lives of our young men and women on the ground in those two, deployed in those two theaters, miserable if they started turning up the burner in Afghanistan and Iraq. So we're not going to establish a no-fly zone plus over Iran. We're not going to do it in Syria either. I suspect the Bahrainis, the ruling family, the Khalifas, shot scores of people. They've now clamped down. Saudis and the Emiratis have put in 1,000-plus troops. Are we going to bomb the Bahrainis? No, of course not. Fifth Fleet is anchored in Manama. Oil is a factor. Security of the Persian Gulf is a factor. No, Libya was easy. You can get away with Libya because it was easy. But the others are not so easy. The others pose all kinds of difficult choices, and we will make choices. Excuse me, I keep saying we. The Obama administration will make choices based on a whole set of different factors. And it's never going to satisfy people who say, well, if you're intervening here, how come you're not intervening there?
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more of our conversation with Aaron David Miller. And a little bit later on in the program, we will be welcoming Joseph Jaffe, who will give us his own take on the Obama Doctrine. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:26. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This hour, we're talking about the so-called Obama Doctrine. What is it? How has it shaped American foreign policy? How does this apply to the situation in Libya and elsewhere? In this portion, and we'll only have him on for a few more minutes, we have Aaron David Miller, Public Policy Fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, former State Department analyst and negotiator, author of the book The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. And we have callers who want to get in on the discussion, and we will start with Zach in Green Bay. Zach, good morning.
thank you. I would just like to suggest that the alternative Bush Republican foreign policy has cost us thousands of young American deaths, tens of thousands of young American wounded. Ultimately, it will cost us over $1 trillion in money for Iraq alone if you include the health care costs of the wounded people. And I would like to suggest that the alternative Bush/Republican foreign policy is to be the world's policeman at the behest of corporate interests and involve a cost that is currently a major reason why we are going bankrupt.
Thanks for the call, Zach. Aaron, would you like to comment on his
comment? Well, I would
only
say, as I mentioned before, that President Obama, in many aspects, has become George W. Bush. And the president had a clear choice in 2009. The military presented him with several options with respect to Afghanistan. He chose not the largest number of troops, but he chose to double down. And whether or not his heart was in that or not, I don't know. So it's not so easy. Yes, these were George Bush's wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. But right now, Afghanistan is President Obama's war. As far as corporate interests, I don't buy that at all. I mean, this has been a canard in American foreign policy for a century. And it is in my judgment, without basis in fact, that American national interests, yes, with respect to, if you mean by corporate interests, you mean oil interests or contractors who make millions as a consequence of their relationship with the U.S. government. When America fights wars, this is what happens. The motivation for these wars were not economic. They were primarily ideological and strategic, with the exception of 1991. In which I believe President George H.W. Bush had a national interest in pushing Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. And yes, in part because we could not allow Saddam to control 40% of the Earth's known petroleum reserves. That had to do, in my judgment, with energy security, which is an international problem. 6 oil tankers a day separate Japan from bankruptcy. So it's in my judgment, this was not driven by corporate interests. This was driven by American national security interests. 2003 was a war of choice, a discretionary war, and it cost America, your caller is absolutely correct, it cost America a lot.
It's 9:30. We have to let you go and welcome our next guest. I really appreciate your time here this morning, and perhaps we can chat about this again.
Love to. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Aaron David Miller, Public Policy Fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, a former State Department analyst and negotiator, and author of the book The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. For the rest of this hour, we're going to be taking a look at the so-called Obama Doctrine from a different viewpoint. We'll get another viewpoint, and we'll take your calls. Here is the phone number, 800-486-8655. There's still a line available for you if you call right now. A number of people are looking to join the program, and we'll be taking those calls in just a few moments. 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to communicate with us that way, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn program on Facebook. You can go there and leave a comment on our Facebook page, and then we'll share that on the air. So 800-486-8655, talk@wpr.org, find us on Facebook. Lots of ways for you to interact with the Kathleen Dunn program. Again, we're talking about the Bush Doctrine, the Obama Doctrine in this hour, the so-called Obama Doctrine. What is it? How has it shaped American foreign policy? What does it mean? Why are we in Libya? What's going on? What's the thought process that guides the Obama administration as it develops its foreign policy? what are the responsibilities of the United States as a world leader, and things like that. All fair game here in this half of the program. Again, the there's a line available if you'd like to call right now and get in the queue. We'll be taking calls in just a moment. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. What do you think? What did you think when you heard the president's speech the other night? I mean, did you think he was coining the Obama doctrine, or is this a phrase that's only useful for pundits on television and maybe on some radio talk shows? What do you think ought to be the guiding principles of American foreign policy? Are we to continue to be the world's police officer? Are we willing to commit the treasure and blood, in some cases, of American soldiers and airmen and sailors? Are we willing to make those commitments around the world in pursuit of some foreign policy goal? What would you like the president to say to further define what he means in his speeches? Those are all things that we can ask and maybe get some answers for. 800-486-8655, talk at WPR.org, or we can be reached on Facebook. You can find the Kathleen Dunn Facebook page and leave a comment there. Okay. My next guest is Joseph Jaffe, Mark and Anita Abramowitz Fellow in the International Relations at the Hoover Institution and publisher and editor of the German weekly Die Zeit. Mr. Jaffe, welcome to the program. Hello, Mr. Jaffe, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you very much.
I have a little problem.
Okay.
I mean, I hear you, but not very, very strongly.
Okay. Well, I'll. Our producers are aware of that. Maybe they can boost my.
Better.
Okay, better now? Okay, great.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for being with me this morning. The theme of this program is, as you know, is we're talking about the what's become known as the Obama Doctrine. It's not a new term.
Yeah.
It's been used about Barack Obama since the presidential primaries in 2008 to describe his approach to foreign policy.
Yeah, yeah.
In your view, what is the Obama Doctrine, and how is it different from the Bush Doctrine?
Are we starting now, or is this a...
Yes, we're starting now.
This?
Well, it's being recorded. We're on live.
Oh, we're on live? Okay.
Yes, this is a live radio program.
Okay. So what's my view of the Obama Doctrine? Well, you know, it's hard to turn a speech like on Libya into a doctrine. But I guess you could. There is a doctrine, and I think it's quite a departure from all previous American presidents, at least since World War II. It really says, you know, we are not going to take over. We'll lead, but only a little. We'll lead for a while, but then we'll let others take over. There is none of the kind of highfalutin rhetoric that attended doctrines from Truman to Kennedy to Bush. It is kind of, if that becomes the pattern for U.S. foreign policy, it's really a departure from the past. It really kind of, it looks like, you know, superpower light. It looks like the U.S., we're going to be more like France and Germany and Britain. We'll be one among the nations, but not the nation. We are going to kind of submit our foreign policy and strategy to the say-so or veto of others. We will only act in common. That, I think, are the elements of what could still become a doctrine.
So, well, what do you see as the United States' responsibility in the world?
Well, I mean, I don't want to talk about me. I'd like to talk about how other presidents, say, in the 20th century have defined responsibility in the world. And that was quite clear. The United States is number one. The United States in a leadership role. We are going to do all the heavy lifting, but we're also going to run the show. And that's why I want to emphasize what I just said. this seems to be quite a rupture with that past, in the sense that U.S. now wants to kind of share responsibility, to be one of the boys, so to speak, rather than the head boy.
So, but what's is it sustainable over time for the United States to maintain that we're number one and we're going to run the show kind of attitude?
Well, I mean, what Obama is saying is the opposite. Obama is saying we can't sustain this. We are not going to do this. We are going to fall back into the ranks of the next tier of powers. That's what he is saying. And I think he has also made a pitch for the argument. He says, we have too many problems at home, and therefore we can't fritter away our attention and our resources abroad. The only question, however, is, and that's another issue of sustainability, is whether there's somebody else to take up the slack. I would not want the world to be run by Nicolas Sarkozy. He couldn't, but also wouldn't want him to run it, because Nicolas Sarkozy is a kind of jack in the box.
Well, what about Angela Merkel?
Angela Merkel has just decreed that the Germans won't even lift a finger in Libya. They won't even participate in the naval embargo, where the Germans had a few ships since, by the way, 9/11 in the Mediterranean to check for terrorists and so on. She won't even contribute to enforcing an arms embargo. So I think you can rule out Angela Merkel and the Germans, as I wrote elsewhere, the days of German assertiveness are over, and the reason is three Reichs and you are out.
Well, so what should the U.S. policy in Libya be? What should we be doing that we're not doing? What shouldn't we be doing that we are doing?
I think you want to make a distinction between a doctrine and this particular case. The doctrine is universal. It's here, there, and everywhere. It's a set of principles by which will determine U.S. policy in subsequent instances. Libya is a special case, and I would not want to turn Libya into a doctrine. Why not? Because, look, there is no burning national interest involved in Libya. This is not Iraq. This is certainly not the Soviet Union in the olden days. Libya does not pose any threat, be it strategic or economic, to the United States. I mean, this argument about blood for oil is really quite silly, because if you want oil, you can get it a lot more cheaply than by starting a war. And moreover, the disturbance of the oil market, the disturbance of Libyan supplies, hasn't really changed the oil market in any way. The prices are high for different reasons. So there is, in the absence of economic and strategic interests, I would think that that there's no burning issue for U.S. involvement here, and that's why I think Obama was kind of dragged into this war the way Clinton was dragged into the Serbian or in the Kosovo war. The point I'm trying to make is, yes, I can understand why the U.S. would be reticent in this particular instance, but I sure as hell would not want to turn this into a doctrine. United States stops being number one and becomes one out of many. I think that is not the American way, and I don't think the world is ready to take the burden off the United States.
We're talking about the so-called Obama Doctrine this hour. You can join us, join our discussion by phone at 800-486-8655. Let's go to the phones, and we'll go to Green Bay first and take a call from Saeed.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Obama's Middle East policy began with a speech he gave in Cairo. It was an outstanding speech. It was gave heart to those in the Middle East seeking democracy. Unfortunately, subsequent Obama administration policy rendered that speech completely hollow. And now, if you ask me what is wrong with American foreign policy in the Middle East, is that it is inconsistent with American national interest. That is, if you look at a country by country of all the countries that are experiencing upheaval in the Middle East, the one where there is absolutely no doubt that regime change is in American national interest, where the most democratic grassroots movement that is has wide acceptance in the population is trying to displace a despotic government that has a long track history of anti-Americanism. It is Iran. Yet we have done absolutely nothing to support the democracy movement in Iran. Now, by the other issue is that American intervention is not just military or nothing. There is a much more productive and powerful soft power that America yields, the sort of soft power that Ronald Reagan and the Pope yielded in the 80s during the Solidarity Movement of Poland, creating an international milieu where indigenous movements can succeed on their own without external military intervention. And the problem is that as we fail in yielding this sort of soft power and supporting indigenous democracy movements, we find ourselves reacting from crisis to crisis, where our choices are both bad: to do nothing and watch tons of people die, as was the case in Benghazi, or to do the costly American military intervention. All of these are incorrect. We should be supporting democracy movements by the simple moral weight of American expression of our own principles of democracy, of liberty, of supporting free speech, by placing not military but political pressure on regimes that don't respect the rights of their own people.
I want to give Mr. Jaffe a chance to respond to this, and then we need to take a break. Mr. Jaffe, go ahead.
I think on a matter of principle, I would agree. You don't ever want to get any foreign policy. Wouldn't want to get into a situation where you do nothing or you start a war. This yes-no kind of either-or is always bad for any kind of policy. Where I have problems, my problems with the speaker, with the caller, begins where the prescription comes in. You know, we should soft power pressure and so on, and we will certainly put a lot of pressure on Iran for a very hardcore national interest, which is, you know, no nukes. To generalize the issue, how do you do that? How do you strengthen the revolutionary forces, so to speak, in a country which is totalitarian? I haven't quite figured out how to do this, but to again agree with the caller, I would fault Obama for his kind of pussyfooting attitude toward the June 12th revolution in Iran, you know, the election forgery and all that. It took Obama quite a while to kind of come out of hiding and say something, and when he did say it, it was kind of very meek or so. Again, you can argue in his favor, what if you scream too hard, that plays in the hands of the despots. But I think what's missing in this in the Obama whatever doctrine we are talking about is a kind of clear-headed, at least, assertion of the principles. We are on the side of liberal and democratic forces. And here there is a failure maybe of determination or will or what have you.
We're going to take a break. We're talking about the Obama Doctrine, and we'll take some more calls for our guest in this half of the program, Joseph Jaffe, Mark and Anita Bramowitz, fellow in international relations at the Hoover Institution, publisher and editor of the German weekly Die Zeit. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This hour we are talking about the so-called Obama Doctrine, which, the Economist, the headline in their story on the speech of, about Libya the other night said, called it the birth of an Obama Doctrine. There's probably some room for disagreement about whether that was the birth of the Obama Doctrine or not, but that certainly was the genesis for this program. And we're not just talking about Libya, we're talking about foreign policy questions in general. My guest in this part of the hour is Joseph Chaffee, Mark and Anita Abramowitz Fellow in International Relations at the Hoover Institution and publisher and editor of the German Weekly. At Stanford, okay.
Yes,
we want to make sure we get everybody in there. Publisher and editor of the German Weekly Die Zeit.
Yeah.
Let's take another call here. We'll go to Ray in Milwaukee next. Good morning,
yeah,
I'm
Ray. A supporter of Mr. Obama. I voted for him. I was very proud to do that. But I want to say right here, I am so disillusioned with this guy. Like you said, it's superpower light. Mr. Obama should put our principles number one when he's thinking about American interests, and he can never go wrong that way. Number one, if he would say to Bahrain and to Yemen, two governments that we are supporting with money, military help, CIA, everything you could imagine, we're pouring in. If you shoot one more of your people, you're not getting another penny from us. As a matter of fact, we're going to help your people in overthrowing you, but through soft power, purely. We're going to send them computers. We're going to send them laptops. We're going to send in a million cell phones. We're going to do everything in our power if you start killing your own people. Now, for him to give this big speech and not say a single word about our allies, Martin Luther King must be turning over in his grave when he sees the way this guy is acting. He has no moral compass. That's what's blowing my mind.
Mr. Chaffee?
Well, you know, that's where when we get to Bahrain and to Yemen, it gets dicey, because these are two cases where the kind of pure, democratic spirit or pure assertion of power runs into problems. And each is a kind of paradigmatic case. Bahrain happens to be home port of the Fifth Fleet, a keystone of American global politics. So you want to make sure that that you don't want to lose something which is very important, in addition to being being a good Democrat and a good liberal. Yemen is another case where you never want to get involved. Yemen has been fighting on and off since the 60s, a civil war with different participants. This is a country which has four times as many guns as it has people. And we sure as hell don't know who the good guys and the bad guys are, because this is a classic civil war situation. And I don't think anybody should get involved in a civil war. By the way, which may also be true for Libya, where it's not quite clear, good guy versus bad guys. But when we get to the nitty-gritty case like Bahrain, critical ally, or Yemen, a hellhole of civil war, that's when doctrines don't work too well. That's when you have to start balancing interests and values, and doctrines don't do that.
Well, if I'm hearing you correctly, then the keystone of foreign policy is that it needs to be pragmatic.
Well, pragmatic means that you know where you want to go. You're just flexible about the ways in which you approach your target. That's what pragmatism is all about. But if you want to call it pragmatic, that's okay. I mean, what are we talking about? We are always talking about moral issues and strategic issues and political interests which don't quite add up to a kind of unified whole, just like in our daily lives, when we deal with conflicting interests and moral obligations. So, and that's why I think doctrines can give you the kind of, over the far on the horizon principle, but then you have to kind of get down to the nitty-gritty. And there are no simple answers. You have to measure obligation and interest, and you also have to measure costs and sustainability. The Libyan case is such an oddball case is because you can almost read it in the Obama speech, we did it because we could. This was easy. The most hated guy in the neighborhood, this country, perfectly laid out for aerial warfare, which we have the upper hand. It doesn't really involve an enormous crisis to the in the oil market. So we did it because we could, and because the risks are very low. And we also thought, and this is where I emphasize thought or believed, that this would be a quickie, because we know democratic nations don't like long, indecisive, and costly wars. By the way, it's not going to be a short war. It's going to be take quite a while. But and finally, the other exception here is that for the first time, the key members of the NATO alliance were really gung-ho. So, you know, the French started shooting before we even made a decision. So there was a kind of serendipitous circumstances which allowed Obama to kind of hang back and to kind of face calculable risks and calculable costs. Libya proves nothing about the real hard stuff.
Okay. Let's take another call. We'll go to Wayne in Ottawa next. Wayne, good morning.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, I voted for this president, but I'll tell you, I don't think I'll vote for him again. He's doing the same thing as Bush did in the Republicans. We keep getting involved in these civil wars over there, and that's what these are. They're civil wars. They've been fighting each other for thousands of years. Now, what else comes to my mind is, when we started to slaughter our own people here at the Kent State University, what would have happened if another country would have said, well, look what they're doing to their own people. They're killing their own people. Let's go and invade the United States. This was nothing more than an invasion on Libya, and it needs to stop. We don't have money here in this country for our own social programs, but they can dip into funds and find billions of dollars for these 1 and 2 week wars that aren't going to last a week or two. They're going to last a lot longer. Thank you.
I'm afraid he's right. It's going to last a lot longer. And by the way, there's another thing that the Libya speech didn't quite stress, or didn't stress at all. The United States is handing over leadership to NATO, but let's not forget, more than half of the sorties over Libya are being flown by the American Air Force and supported by American ships in the Mediterranean. So here's the ultimate irony. Yes, you know, the U.S. is handing it over to the others, but it's still pulling most of the weight. And that, I think, makes no sense. If you're gonna lift most of the weight, you really want to be in charge. So I would fault them on a very pragmatic reason. You don't do that.
Let's. I want to take another call here before we get to the end of the program, and we're almost out of time. Glenn in Manitowoc, and I'll ask you to be as concise as you can.
I'll try to be extremely brief. I seem to be taking a different view from everything I've been hearing. What I'm taking away from this is Obama is attempting to do a paradigm shift that is long overdue, at a minimum of 10 years. What he isn't attempting to do, in my eyes, is force the rest of the world to take on and put some spine and start doing some lifting to the rhetoric they always want us to do. And even more importantly, in the region, he's extricating ourselves from having the fingers pointed and the blame game, and for the region, that in other words, forcing the rest of the world to take responsibility for their own choices. That's what I see Obama really doing. It's a huge Obama paradigm shift, as I see, and I see it as a positive and long overdue. This country cannot afford to continue doing what we've done ever since World War II. The Cold War is over. It's time for the rest of the countries to pony up to the bar, so to speak.
All right, Glenn, thank you. Mr. Jaffe, we only have about a minute.
Well, I think, you know, if the rest of the world ponied up to the bar and plunked down its silver dollars, that would be nice, except the reality is such that even this particular operation, as I said, I'm just going to repeat myself, is the U.S. is doing the heavy lifting but letting others determine the course of policy. I have one, at the end of our conversation, I have one very nice observation to make, I think. If we look at all these Arab democratic revolutions, the nicest thing about it is that the so-called Arab street, which supposedly hates the West and America and Israel, there was no flag burning, there were no demonstrations against the United States, the West against Israel. Uncle Sam was not burnt in effigy. Flags were not, the stars and stripes were not torn up and burned. And I think that is, whoever is responsible for it, I think that's a very heartening sight, that, so to speak, the dog that didn't bark.
Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Okay.
Joseph Jaffe is the Mark and Anita Abramowitz Fellow in International Relations at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and publisher and editor of the German weekly Die Zeit. Earlier in the hour, we heard from Aaron David Miller, Public Policy Fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Chrissy Pease produced this hour of programming. Katie Mattson handled on-air production. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.